such talent as I can.
Morning, everybody. Please be seated.
Morning, everybody. We have two cases on the calendar, but before we get to them, I wanted to introduce our new temporary colleague for today. Chief Judge Silver is out of town at a conference, so we're honored to have former Justice and Chief Justice Seda with us today. All right, and I know that both of the cases today are here through the pro bono program. I wanted to thank all the attorneys here. I don't know if the attorneys for the next case are here yet, but I wanted to thank all of you for volunteering to help out in cases like this. As you guys know, the system has way too many cases where lawyers aren't willing to step up, and we really do appreciate that you guys have come in here and done a really good job and helped out people who needed the help. And we hope that you'll take cases. More cases in the future. We also hope that you'll tell your colleagues about this program in the future. Maybe we can get everybody who needs an attorney to have an attorney. All right, first case up is case number 68871, Alfred Centofanti versus Romeo Aranis. I apologize if I mispronounced that. Can everybody state their appearances for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Adam Breeden on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Centofanti.
All right, and who's your opposing counsel?
Joseph Tornacosta for the state.
All right, thank you. All right, counsel, before we begin, do you wish to reserve any rebuttal time?
I should reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes. All right, you will have that, and you may proceed.
Okay, well, thank you, Judge Towne. May it please the court. there are two issues raised in the briefing for today's appeal. There is a due process argument that's made, but I'm going to focus on the primary issue that I see for this appeal, which is the procedure that was used to dismiss this writ of mandamus petition. And of course, this was originally raised in the district court as opposed to originally in the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, and then appealed after it was summarily denied. And the reason for summarily denying it was a rather brief comment in an order that because Mr. Centofanti could have or might have also filed a civil rights tort action, for example, under 28 United States Code section 1983, that the district court could simply summarily deny his writ petition. And that is the primary issue that I see in this appeal. It might interest the court to know that the Nevada Supreme Court actually addressed this exact issue in a 2016 unreported case of Kieran versus Feel. I have the citation if that's needed, but that case concerned an inmate who brought a writ of mandamus challenging the denial of services of a notary while he was incarcerated. And the district court, again, summarily denied that petition, saying that a civil rights action could have been filed, and therefore there was another adequate speedy, plain remedy at law, so the petition could simply be summarily denied. Now, the Nevada Supreme Court considered that argument. They actually reversed and remanded the summary denial of that petition, but they did it on a slightly different basis. They said, well, there's no constitutional right to a notary, so this isn't a constitutional civil rights case, so we're going to remand it for that reason. So this hearing case sort of leaves open the issue of, well, if there is truly a civil rights case, can the writ petition still be summarily denied?
Counsel, I have a question. Do we need to be concerned about whether or not administrative remedies were exhausted below?
Well, I think, yes, you do, and that was certainly mentioned in the district court's order. I will say, and of course, the only real evidence in this case are the filings of my client. And he did allege in the petition that administrative remedies would be futile, and for that reason that he, and I believe would take too long to adjudicate his administrative remedies. The prison grievance process is a fairly long one, or can be, and therefore he was filing the writ petition.
This may be a little outside the scope, but I'm curious, as you know, the appellate process is not that fast either. During the many months that this case has been briefed and lingered around and all that kind of stuff, has anything happened on the administrative front?
Well, on the administrative front, my understanding is that my client actually did go through the administrative process. In his petition, he describes a history of years of problems getting medical care for his various afflictions, or appropriate medical care, in his opinion. and that his grievances simply went nowhere or were not responded to. So on the administrative front, that's the evidence that, for example, had the district court said, hey, I want to give Mr. Cintafante a chance to explain this issue about administrative remedies, what has occurred, my client could have come forth with an affidavit explaining that. Instead, we just have the allegations in the original writ petition that explain that that process is both too long and has proved to be futile for my client. So, continuing with this exact issue, we have numerous cases from the Nevada Supreme Court where it seems that this issue has already been implicitly decided. We have the Falke case, which was not an inmate case, but a case that concerned land use and applicability of a statute, and a writ petition was sought. And part of the defense to that was to say, well, you could have just filed a declaratory relief action to declare the statute unconstitutional or what the correct interpretation was. And the Nevada Supreme Court says, well, that might be true, but that doesn't necessarily preclude all writ of mandamus relief. And that was the holding in the Falke case. And if you look at other inmate cases, we have very similar situations that have been presented via writ of mandamus, where if the decision below in this case is going to stand, then I think you would have to say, well, those petitions should have just been summarily denied because they could have been presented as civil rights claims. And here I'm speaking about the two Stockmeyer cases. Those concerned the diet of a prisoner or the Department of Corrections duties to do reporting and studies on prisoner meals. And also the first Stockmeyer decision concerned applicability of a psychological review board to that prisoner's case. You also have the Douglas case, which concerned a psychological review panel. All of those are cases where writ of mandamus relief was eventually granted. Some of those cases, I believe two out of the three, involved the district court originally denying the writ petition, and it goes to the Nevada Supreme Court. And they reverse and remand and say this particular petition could have been granted. In all three of those,
what was the basis of the remand? I mean, why did they send it back? Why did they say that it should have been heard, could have been heard? What would the court say?
That issue does not seem to have been heavily discussed by the Nevada Supreme Court. In other words, those decisions were based on the fact that, well, the district court just got the law wrong. The law does entitle this inmate to the relief that he's seeking or compliance with the law. The underlying decisions in those cases were not summarily denied on the basis that a civil rights claim could have been filed or there was another form of relief like a negligence suit or something. So while those cases don't directly address the issue in this case, you can see that if the district courts are free to just deny these petitions because they could be brought as prisoner civil rights cases, then that should have been the result in, for example, the Stockmeyer case, which is a very recent Nevada Supreme Court decision, had to do with prisoner diet. That certainly could be brought as a civil rights case, denying state law and correct health and diet of prisoners. So why didn't the Nevada Supreme Court in that case say, well, wait, the real remedy here is a civil rights action, so we're not even going to hear this petition? Instead, not only did they hear it, they reversed and remanded with instructions to grant the petition. The state can be expected to argue here that these writs are simply discretionary and that to reverse a decision denying them, you have to find arbitrary or capricious behavior. And that is the legal standard. Although when you look at the Nevada Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this issue, you'll find case after case after case where these writs are granted in similar inmate petitions. When you talk about arbitrary behavior, and this is why I think it's so important that this court issue a decision that can provide guidance to the district courts on this particular issue. Imagine a scenario, and this appears to be not too far from the truth as to what's going on here, Imagine that Judge X and Judge Y are from the same district, and Judge X believes, well, I can just deny any or most of these inmate writs that I get by saying they could file civil rights claims, so I'm just going to summarily deny them all. But Judge Y has a different position, that they should be considered on their merits. So now you have a rather arbitrary factor that's deciding these cases and whether they're heard on the merits, and just simply has to do with which judge is randomly assigned to the case.
Interestingly enough, on our next case, that's one of the arguments submitted by the amicus. That the same procedure, but different judges are going on it, so we should do an opinion to clarify.
I promise you I did not peek at that brief, Judge Gibbons.
But in fact, that is a pervasive issue across not only our state, but I suspect other states, inconsistent decisions from the trial court. You're not suggesting that we should mandate decision-making. I mean, I understand that we have to comply with the law when we're sitting in the district courts. But isn't there some element of judicial discretion in the decision-making?
There absolutely is some judicial discretion. Many litigants might say, well, it's the luck of the draw what district court judge you might happen to be assigned. And that's a little disturbing to me from the idea that somewhere out there in outer space is the law, right? And it should be equally applied. But when you look at discretion and what occurred in this particular case, the district court's judge doesn't even seem to have stated why he felt a civil rights action would be an adequate, plain, speedy remedy of law. There's a couple of things about this particular petition that I think set it apart from some other cases, and I'll just throw out an example. There was a case, I believe it's called Morrow, where the petitioner objected to prison protocols allowing him to review his own prison record. In this case, you have medical care of prisoners at issue. So a money damages case is not going to be particularly helpful to a prisoner who needs medical care. Okay. A civil rights action could take years to litigate, and if filed under Section 1983, could be removed to federal court, which would deny these prisoners a state court venue for the remedies that they seek. So I think there are a lot of things about this particular writ, even if you didn't find as a general rule that these should not be summarily denied, that it was error for this particular writ to be denied. I see here that I'm coming to the close of my time, so I'll just conclude by saying, making the relief that we seek clear. My client asks that this court give some direction to the lower court on this particular issue of whether any and every inmate writ of mandamus petition can simply be summarily denied if you can look at it and say, this could have been filed as a civil rights action, so we're denying any mandamus relief. I think that broad statement of law is something that this court could adjudicate. But even if you did not want to come out with a broad, all-encompassing statement of law, you could say, looking at the particular facts of this writ, where it concerns medical care, where it seeks sort of a systemic or fundamental change in the way inmates are given medical care, that this particular writ, because of the type of relief that it sought, should not have been summarily denied.
Counsel, I don't want to bleed into your time, and I suspect that our chief will give you one more minute because I'm going to ask this question. So you're saying your prayer for relief is the judge has to write something more than the 1983 action was adequate. What would that be in your mind?
Well, and all we really have in this opinion is just a bare citation to the law. It says you can't deny if there's an adequate remedy at law. I think it would have been nice if the judge had put something in there, and of course I'm not going to write the opposing view, but you know, a judge in granting this petition could have said, I don't think there's an adequate speedy remedy at law here. They're seeking medical care as opposed to money damages, and this matter has already continued for Mr. Cintafante for years without change, and mandamus is the correct procedural writ to compel a state officer to perform a duty required at law rather than a money damages claim. Thank you.
All right, and considering that Justice Hayden did ask a question at the very end, I will add some time in. So let's give him the original 3 minutes. He's only about a minute beyond that. So, all right, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Judge Tao, may it please the court. And we will keep taking these cases at the AG's office.
Right.
Mr. Cintafante attacks a straw man. He's attacking an argument that nobody has made. He suggests that the district court denied his bid because it found that a 1983 action was conceivable. The district court didn't say that. The district court didn't apply that. What the district court did, by contrast, was to look at the sprawling factual allegations in this case and the sweeping relief sought and to conclude that you couldn't have substance matter less appropriate for a writ. Mr. Cintafante wants a court, through a mandamus order, to effect a comprehensive overhaul of the NDOT medical system. He described a sort of horror show that puts him and 3,500 other inmates at risk. He says the doctors are bad, the nurses are bad, the emergency care is bad, the non-emergency care is bad. Everything is bad, and it violates administrative regulations, a state statute, the federal and state constitutions. You couldn't begin to craft a mandamus order on facts like these. What facts like these do look like, however, is well known. NDOT gets sued hundreds of times a year. Dozens of cases make allegations about the quality of medical care. These are Eighth Amendment claims. They could also be medical malpractice claims. Maybe negligent supervision claims. These are well known. There are proper, legal, non-writ avenues to handle these. It seemed to me at least partially ironic that these other affidavits that he files from other inmates reference these adequate legal means. The first affidavit, he talks about, he has a federal court case going. The second inmate talks about a state tort suit. The third talks about all the grievances he's been filed.
Counsel, I'm perplexed why there was no response filed to this. That some of the facts you just asserted to us could have been in a response that would have made it clear to the district court that discretion shouldn't have been exercised, but the district court just acted without a response, without a hearing. Wouldn't you want to get all these facts into the record?
I would, Your Honor, and we normally do respond to these, and I looked into why we didn't respond. I have to go outside the record here, but it looks like the NDOC was served, and they never got this to their attorneys at the Attorney General. So our office never saw it. If we had a chance to respond, we would have said precisely what the district court said, which is that this is plainly 1983 med mal. The district court is allowed to rule without a hearing. And obviously the district court was able to reach the correct legal result without even hearing it, because it's so manifest. It is, incidentally, precisely the result that the Nevada Supreme Court reached in the unpublished Sanchez decision in 2012, in almost the same number of words. Which is to say, you think the medical care is lackluster? 1983. But it's not a writ case.
The counsel for the appellant has indicated we should come up with some sort of opinion that lays out the factors for the district court to decide, to apply, to decide how to exercise its discretion. Is there anything out there in the law that would do this in this circumstance, or is it going to just be different from every district judge, every department?
The puzzling thing about that argument is I find that it is already the law in Nevada. It has been the law, the earliest case I find is from the 1940s, saying that just because some non-writ remedy is possible, you have to dismiss it. Writ, we're talking about very broad class. Writ is a very broad class. Courts have tremendous flexibility and discretion. They ought to have it. We file as many writs as anyone. What the Nevada Supreme Court decides a writ case, without exaggeration, every few days. And what all successful writs have in common, and this includes Mr. Cintafante's citations, is a combination of three things. There is no broad rule that you can say, always appropriate here, never appropriate here. It won't work with writs. But they all have three things in common. One is you have a mandatory, non-discretionary duty that's going unfulfilled. Second, you have a case that's capable of resolution as a matter of law. There's not a lot of messy and contested facts. And third, there's no obvious and adequate non-writ remedy. Of those three factors, I find that the preeminent one is that writs are really appropriate for essentially legal decisions and not for fact-intensive ones. Few types of cases are more fact-intensive than medical malpractice. They usually require a good deal of discovery. In Nevada, a plaintiff cannot prevail unless you have a doctor come in and explain why the accused doctor got it wrong. And I can illustrate this distinction between writ-appropriate cases on the law and non-writ-appropriate fact cases by reference to his own, the administrative regulations he cites. He cites two. One requires the creation of a committee to evaluate prison health. The other one requires NDOC to issue statistics and reports on medical care. We would begin to be entering appropriate writ territory if his argument was something like, they have never formed this committee, or they've never issued these reports. Then we'd have a binary duty, not a lot of facts, no facts except admission or denial, and a clear legal duty that was being violated. Or take Stockmeyer versus Green, which he seems to believe is his best case. A state law says that the chief medical officer of the state, not the end doctor, by the way, the chief medical officer of the state has a duty to assess nutrition for inmates. The inmate got the writ in that case because he was able to show that there was a clear non-discretionary duty that was being completely flubbed, and the chief medical officer essentially admitted it. So that's appropriate for writ. The Supreme Court continued by saying that we're not going to get into the discretionary aspects. We're not going to tell anyone what sort of menus to have in these prisons. We're not going to do caloric counts. We're just saying, the law says you got to do something. You're doing nothing. And so we're going to order you to do something. Now compare the statute in the Stockmeyer case to the one that he cites as the one supposedly being violated. He cites essentially the Enabling Act for the NDOC, the entire prison system. This is the broadest statute that exists in the code with reference to prison. It says there's going to be an NDOC director, and his or her job is to run a prison system. You can't possibly extrapolate a specific duty to provide certain medical care in certain ways from that. Medical care is about as discretionary as it gets. He's saying doctors misdiagnose him, nurses aren't reading medication labels properly, not doing triage in the right way, or giving a medication without paying proper attention to side effects. This is pure discretion. A mandamus order doesn't make sense in a case like this.
You mentioned the Med-Mal cases, though, but interestingly enough, there's quite a few cases where the district court has dismissed it because there's no affidavit from a doctor, and they may say they can't get a doctor because the prison won't cooperate. So is that really an alternative?
That is an alternative. I argued that case in front of the Supreme Court a few weeks ago. The Supreme Court has said that you have to have an affidavit. It is not true that prisoners cannot get affidavits. In fact, prisoners have as much access to affidavits as anyone else. Prisoners do, on occasion, get affidavits. If you are injured in Las Vegas and you're not in prison, you typically write a lawyer. The lawyer finds the doctor, and the lawyer takes on contingency. That's how it works. Inmates have just as much right to seek out lawyers or to seek out doctors. And in fact, most of the prisoners are seeing the same doctors that people out in the public see. I mean, this urologist that he was seeing, this is not an end-doc staff urologist. These are urologists in private practice. So they do not, in fact, have an access problem. What's interesting about this case in particular is that he says, if you want to look at these facts, he says that these terrible things happened to him. He has this ruptured scrotum in end of December. And then he sees a urologist in January, February, March, April. They do cystoscopies, prescribe medication, treatment. He attaches not a single medical record. He didn't file a single grievance. grievances being, of course, the universal kickoff to all prison cases, because it gives first a court a chance to see the prison side, to build up a record, to give prison a chance to address.
That would be the administrative process.
That's the administrative process. In federal court, it's an exhaustion requirement. You can't come unless you've exhausted.
But was that really even used in this case, though? Counsel for the appellant said that that was part of the decision, but I don't recall that.
It's the last sentence of his order. The district court notes, and I thought perceptibly, that Mr. Centofanti doesn't allege they filed an agreement.
Okay, he didn't allege it, so the district court couldn't determine if it had or had not, but since he hadn't alleged it, it's as if he had not exhausted his remedies.
Yeah, he didn't attach anything, which to me suggests, actually, a pretty close reading by the district court. I mean, the district court noticed that there's no administrative procedures followed here, unlike his fellow co-affiants, these other inmates. How would the district court have known that if he had read the pleadings, the petition carefully, and he had combed through the record? I thought that it showed careful reading. I do think it would be unwise to require now, of course, there's a concern about contrary decisions. This is an easy case. It's enough to say that in this case, writ relief is wholly inappropriate. But I would add that I would think it unwise to require district courts to engage in extensive factual recitation, which in this case would be a dozen pages, or detailed legal analysis when the proper legal answer is so self-evident as it is in this case.
So you would suggest, counsel, then, that the judge in his order, by saying there were other remedies, actually he added the inter alia, which means there is this remedy and others. You're saying that's enough. The appellant thinks that there should be a reason for that. Do we need one?
No. 95% of cases in which an inmate challenges the medical care are brought in 1983 cases. Inmates know this. The suggestion that cases take time, well, yes, they do, but that's because you actually do need to sort out some of these facts. There's no appropriate way to bypass this. I mean, in order to evaluate a case like this, I'm not sure I've seen a case. There are dozens of medical events challenged as a problem. How would a district court evaluate that on a writ? Do we submit documents? Do we take depositions? That would be a start. But once you do that, now it's starting to look like a normal district court proceeding. Writs are appropriate for dealing with legal issues where there's not a lot of facts. I don't think that the district court needs to say more. The Nevada Supreme Court in Sanchez didn't think you needed to say more. Okay. Just one point on this. He says that the district court erred because he only filed state law claims. And the district court pointed him to a 1983 action. The district court could be forgiven for thinking that since he says that the NDOC is violated in Nevada and U.S. Constitution's Record on Appeal 14. Later that the NDOC is violating the state and federal constitutions, Record on Appeal 19. 1983 is what would come to the mind of any district court judge paying attention, because that's how these cases are always brought. Lastly, on the due process point, due process means notice and opportunity to be heard before the government does something to you. He got notice because he filed the thing, and he had an opportunity to be heard in having the district court consider and rule on his petition. He suggests that courts can't rule on the briefs. Every court does, including this court, all the time. And he suggests that he gets a sort of sneak peek at the district court's tentative position before the district court is allowed to rule. I've never heard of any such rule in any jurisdiction.
Well, in fact, in
California, like that. California, they have an indicated ruling, and then you can challenge it. But sorry to interrupt you.
I was going to say, doesn't NRS 34.260 actually, depending on how you read it, preclude discovery? It says the case shall be heard on the papers of the applicant. So, I mean, to the extent, depending on how you read that and how it interacts with other statutes and how you're getting your question of statutory interpretation, does that even allow for discovery or some sort of extensive fact-finding procedure?
I don't think so, Governor. And that's why writs are these a special, extraordinary remedy that you're not allowed to get it. I'm sure I read that provision as saying if the other side doesn't file anything, you do it on the papers. There is a provision in that same subsection that says that a court can decide if it does seem to be pretty fact-heavy, a court can order a trial on the facts.
But what does that mean? Does that mean a court can order the entirety of the civil procedure discovery remedies be incorporated into these writs? What does it allow a court to do if the court decides it needs fact-finding?
Well, I suppose a court could try, but the problem is that then what's the point of writlet? Is it just then a parallel proceeding to a normal civil case? I just had never seen it used that way.
Writs, by their very nature, are extraordinary. Is that not correct?
Yeah, very much so. They're extraordinary. And it doesn't mean the court doesn't have discretion. They can be used for all sorts of things. Clarify an issue of law that lower courts are getting wrong. If there's some legal question that has to be decided now, before you have a six-month trial, the court can use it in that way. It's judicial resources. Kind of one point on the tentative ruling thing in California. Just as an academic thing, the California tentative ruling, the way that works is the court basically issues its decision. And it gives you, it's called tentative, but it really is a final decision. And you just have a chance to sort of ask for an immediate reconsideration. But it's definitely not a sneak peek. You should practice there. Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
And on rebuttal, you have 3 minutes. And counsel, my first question is this. Essentially, isn't the danger of what we're proposing the following, that an inmate with a claim like this is going to get four possible remedies for relief? A writ proceeding, which is what you're proposing here, possible civil rights remedy, plus a possible administrative remedy, plus, in this kind of case, a possible med-mal tort suit. So anytime you have four avenues available, aren't you talking about a waste of judicial resources, and on top of that, possibly inconsistent verdicts on what is essentially the same claim?
Well, and you may have some res judicata or claim or issue preclusion issues in repetitive filings. For example, if the writ of mandamus is unsuccessful, so then you go out and you file a medical malpractice claim. It's possible, depending upon how far along your writ petition got, if there were any findings of fact or conclusions of law in it, that it may preclude later actions.
Well, this goes back to your point about how different judges and different departments may be doing different things. Now you might have the same claim in front of four different forums, three judges and one administrative hearing officer. Doesn't that make the problem of different judges doing different things even worse?
Well, again, I think that the writ of mandamus process just simply requires that possibility that there might be some different avenues that an inmate in particular might take advantage of.
Isn't that precisely why we reserve writs for, as I mentioned, extraordinary relief and a fully developed record? That's my concern, is that in this posture, we don't have a fully developed record. That's why perhaps other remedies are more appropriate, as the judge said.
Well, we don't have a fully developed record because this writ was simply summarily denied. It was shut down before any real record could be prepared. And to address Judge Tao's questions to the state's counsel, my experience is if these writ petitions make a certain level that a response is ordered and that an appendix can be ordered. And if there are different assertions of facts, that's where you could have a trial. And I think there's a lot of discretion for the court to allow discovery as well if that's needed to resolve one of these writ petitions. But you talk about a medical malpractice claim, all that can provide somebody is money. Okay, we're talking about my client wishes to say that, hey, the medical director or the Department of Corrections are not following state law, they're not providing adequate medical care, and there needs to be a remedy to that, telling them you need to do X, you need to do Y to comply with state law. And that's why this was brought as a mandamus. And it's clear from the scant record that there is in this case that my client is not bringing it only to address his issues, but he's bringing it for other inmates. So there were probably 4 to 6 affidavits from other inmates attesting.
Well, why couldn't you ask for injunctive relief in a med-mal suit? I mean, nobody ever does that because there's no, in a typical medical malpractice suit, there's no injunctive relief that you care about. An injunction that says don't commit malpractice in the future doesn't mean anything. But in the inmate situation, if it's a med mal claim, why can't you ask for an injunctive, in some sort of injunctive? There's no reason why you can't, is there?
You could. I think the reason why an inmate might choose to use writ relief is that it should, in theory, be a faster process. I'd like to leave with one point about the Sanchez case very quickly. It's been cited in the briefs and argued here today. That is an unpublished decision from 2012, so it's inappropriate to argue that.
We both did that, but just saying.
Mine is post-2016, though, so it is citable. This is a pre-2012.
Understood.
And that opinion is very scant on facts. It was a proper person, so I don't know the appropriate briefing occurred in the Sanchez matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both of you.